Do you know what state interposition is and how it works? Find out next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy and the Executive Director of Camp American. And that question that we ask is actually a follow-up to last week's program. Last week, we ran a program on the Principles of 98. This is really the Principles of 98 Part 2, and we got a little introduction to what the problems were in the period of the second president of the United States, John Adams, and we come to find out that it's very similar to today's issues with government overstepping its bounds and violating its constitutional principles. Well, the question we asked last week was, what recourse do states have and the people have if the government oversteps its bounds? And that recourse is actually laid out in kind of a slightly nebulous form in the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution. So what is it exactly that the 10th Amendment says? Well, the 10th Amendment is pretty clear. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So what does it mean that those powers are delegated to the states or to the people respectively and not delegated to the federal government? Well, the fact that the states and the people are the ones who ultimately delegate power means by logical inference that the states and the people are who can deny the powers that are being usurped by the federal government, can deny them the authority to usurp those powers. You'll have a number of people, even people who call themselves conservative, who call that a dangerous idea. The underlying notion is a word that has gotten a bad reputation that really shouldn't have a bad reputation, and that is the idea of nullification. Now, nullification, all that simply means is the states take a look at a federal piece of federal legislation, a law, actually, that's been passed as a law and signed into law by the president or allowed to pass in some other way, perhaps by an administrative usurpation, which happens all the time with administrative agencies, OSHA, EPA, the Bureau of Land Management, as we're seeing out west currently, those kinds of things. Well, the states take a look at that and say, well, not in our state, you don't. Now, there is a mechanism that's outlined for that, and that mechanism is called interposition. In other words, the state, or what's called the lower magistrate, interposes between the people and the higher magistrate. And this is the way that nullification or interposition, and I prefer the phrase interposition because what it means is that the lower magistrate or the lower lawmaking body is actually interposing itself between a tyrant and the people. And this is the way you do nullification of a tyrannical act in order that you do not create an anarchic situation. In other words, you really don't want anarchy to reign, and what can happen is if people take directly the responsibility to nullify law on themselves, then that actually tends to very often empower the tyrant. And these phrases are, some people consider them inflammatory. Well, these are commonly used phrases. Someone who is usurping authority that he doesn't have is, in effect, a tyrant. Even if he's a benevolent tyrant, he's still a tyrant. He is utilizing power that he has not been given. He is usurping authority because that authority lies with the people and with the state governments. Well, that being said, there is a way to do it that is an acceptable biblical way of dealing with a tyrant. And there are numerous biblical examples I can think of, especially in the Old Testament. David at one point interposed between Saul and the people when Saul was kind of running roughshod over the people. There are a number of biblical examples. It is a biblical principle that the lower magistrate should interpose himself between the tyrant and the people. Well, that being said, how does that exactly does it work? Well, Barry Sheets, once again, takes up the challenge, and he is running a workshop. Now, one thing I will tell you, this is an audio presentation of a video, and that is available from Camp American. And in that video, it's got all the demonstrations and that kind of thing that aren't effectively shown in this audio. So I would think seriously about buying a copy of the video. You'll help Camp American raise some money, and you'll have a first-rate video of how the visuals that Barry is using as part of his teaching technique. And he does a great job on this. Now, if you want to know more about Camp American, where this is being taught, I would go to www.campamerican.com. That's campamerican.com, not campamerica.com, Camp American. And you can find out more about Camp American. And it is coming up in June 15th through the 21st. That's June 15th through the 21st. That's Sunday evening through Saturday before noon. So again, we're going to cut to Barry Sheets, and we'll come back at the end and give you more opportunity to find something out about Camp American. So here is Barry Sheets with part two of the Principles of 98, the workshop.
All right, guys, like I said, we're going to have a lot more interaction this hour. So everybody make sure you've got your pocket constitutions handy, because we're going to be looking some things up. Because we've seen what the view of the Federalists were, and we've seen what Jefferson the Republican's view is, but they're both assuming the Constitution says something. Well, let's quit assuming. Let's look at it. So the constitutional view, 10th Amendment, we've already read, thank you, Luke, earlier, that the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Okay. What powers are we talking about? Because we have to understand that words have meaning. One of my favorite phrases from James Madison is that, and you guys could write this down if you want to. I'll write it up here on the board, as a matter of fact. I want to do this. I'll write it up here on the board because you have to remember this. It's important. Every word in the Constitution, okay, every word in the Constitution determines a question of liberty and power. James Madison, okay? In these more lucid moments. Madison was right. Every word in this document determines a question of liberty and power. Because you're either going to have freedom to do something, or you're going to be restricted by a government having the power over you. Right? That's why the Constitution's important, ladies and gentlemen. That's why you're here at camp. That's why we have to sit here and study this. These are not dead words. This isn't a 230-year-old document that is a nice piece of antiquity that you have to read for a class to get a credit in. This is how we are supposed to be operating today, 21st century, June 25th of 2012. Or else we'll go back to June 25th of 1798. Yes, Mike.
It's also not a living document.
Yes, it is also not a living document. That's the reason why we talked about that strict constructionist view that Jefferson and the Republicans had.
Because they would basically say that what they said back 250 years ago, 30 years ago, is no longer relevant.
Well, you know, obviously they didn't have the internet and they didn't have cell phones and texting, so is this whole idea about, you know, looking at your correspondence antiquated? Or is it just that technology's moving forward, but the basic principles are all still the same. Basic principles are all still the same. So we're going to look in this Constitution. The power we're talking about is the power to write a law. Okay? Does anybody know what a law is? Now, this is scary. Nobody knows what a law is. So if I say anybody wearing a black t-shirt should be taken out and summarily executed, is that a law? If Barack Obama was to come out today and say, the Supreme Court no longer has any authority in the United States, we are disbanding the court, is it law? If Congress, John Boehner and Mitch McConnell or Harry Reid, get together and say, well, we've decided that the American public all must wear blue shoes, is it a law? No. Luke. No, you can pass laws with simple majorities, with 50% plus one of a vote. So, but what is the basic idea of a law?
A rule?
It's a rule that does what?
It keeps order?
Keeps order? Well, that's part of it, yes. How does it keep order? Yes, and your name is, young lady?
Maria.
Maria? Okay, Maria, what do you think?
A lot of like a rule that
Yeah, there's part of it being having to be executed and also to be obeyed. So you're right, that is part of legitimate law. Yes, sir, your name is?
Raymond.
Okay, thank you, Raymond. Your thoughts?
A bill passed
by Congress? A bill passed by Congress. Well, you know what? That's what the vast majority of the American public think. But the big problem is that most of the bills passed by Congress are not law. They're not truly law. What is law? Okay, Webster?
Something that follows God's commandments.
That's the very first thing. It has to follow God's law to be a legitimate law. So if it violates the law of God, it's not a legitimate law. Now, you'll have many legislators and lawmakers and legal scholars who will immediately say that I'm a fool, that it has nothing to do with law. Problem is, our founders didn't believe that. And if you looked at their writings, it was very clear from almost every one of their writings, except maybe Tom Paine and maybe Ben Franklin, although in later in life, maybe not, that they did believe that there was no legitimacy for a law unless it comported with God's law. Okay, so that's basic. That's foundational underpinning one. What's law? What else is law? Now, I thought I saw some hands up in the back. Arnie.
You should have a provision for a punishment.
It has a penalty provision to it most of the time for disobedience of it, okay? Well, a law can only be a law if it's issued by a legitimate authority. That's the first thing. Has to be issued by, it's a rule of regulating conduct or action. That's what a law is. It regulates conduct or action either by individuals or by entities. And it has to be issued by a legitimate authority. Where's the legitimate authority? It's sitting right up here in front of you. Article 1, Section 1 of your Constitution. Everybody turn there. Everybody turn. Article 1, Section 1. It's very right after the preamble. After the ones that you memorized when you were a little kid and heard on Schoolhouse Rock. You know, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure. I'm not going to stand up here and sing it, okay? You all know it. Yeah, get the Schoolhouse Rock DVDs and listen to it again. But Article 1, Section 1 spells out where the law-making authority rests. All legislative powers. See, that's the powers they were talking about in the Constitution. All legislative powers herein granted. So in other words, inside here enumerated, herein granted. In other words, what's actually laid out in words in the Constitution that determines questions of liberty and power. So all legislative powers granted herein shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. So in other words, can the president make a law? Can the president make a law? Well, he's doing it with executive order. And we're going to talk about those abuses here in a little bit. Can the judiciary, the Supreme Court, make a law? Can they like wake up today and come up to the microphone and say, we've decided a new law that anybody wearing a hat is going to be in prison for 10 years. Start immediately. So, myself and Ben, we're gone. We're gone. Anybody else wearing a hat in here? You are, okay. we might give an exception for toboggan type things. Okay, but the point is the Congress has to do it, and the Congress consists of a Senate and a House of Representatives. That is the first standard in the Constitution, that there's only one body that makes law at the federal level, a Congress. All legislative powers. It didn't say some. It didn't say the ones that the president decided he didn't want to take for himself. It didn't say the ones that the Supreme Court decided that they didn't want to be bothered with. All legislative powers here in Granite shall be vested in the Congress. Okay? But a law based in God's law, setting a rule of conduct or prohibiting certain conducts, issued by a legitimate authority. That's what true law is. Okay? Now, if we're going to be talking about all those legislative powers, and we've looked at the 10th Amendment, we're going to have to look at where these powers reside, because, again, Mr. Madison, every word is determining a question of liberty and power. So all of these words, if you turn to Article 1, Section 8, and we're not going to read all these words, okay? You can read them on your own, and if we do a year of the class where we teach IOTC, you'll be reading through all of them. But the point is, Article 1, Section 8 has a list of about 18 different spelled out provisions that say the Congress shall have power. The Congress. So in other words, the lawmaking body, the only legitimate lawmaking body in the country at the federal level, shall have power, means they have authority, they have the right to do so, to what? And then the next 18 things are spelling out or enumerating what Congress legitimately can issue true laws regarding. Now, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to bust some people's bubbles in here. Congress does not have any authority in these 18 provisions over health care. Congress does not have any authority in these 18 provisions over the press. Congress does not have any authority in these 18 provisions, because we look at the First Amendment, to tell you that everybody has to worship at a Unitarian Universalist gathering, or prohibit you from being a Presbyterian. Congress only has the authority in these particular 18 enumerated powers. They have power to lay and collect taxes. Boo, hiss. I know. You know, when you guys all get old enough to pay taxes, you're going to be booing and hissing. Trust me, your parents around the room do boo and hiss. To borrow money, regulate commerce, establish the post office, to declare war. Big one there. What? The president can't take us into war? He's commander in chief, right? Nope. Only Congress has the authority to declare war. Now, the president can get us into some messes and stick troops in fights, but he has to come back to Congress within a certain amount of time to get them to either approve it by declaring war or to say, nope, bring you guys home. Now, oftentimes Congress abrogates that authority and punts and doesn't do it. Now he's kind of continuing resolutions, spending money for it, but they never actually come out and say, we're declaring war. So there's other things they can do. Provide for the calling forth of militia. Now there's a last phrase in that Article 1 section that says, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. So in other words, any other law that they make has to be directly related to the need to carry out one of the enumerated powers, specifically. Okay, if you're going to coin money, do you think you have to pass a law just stating what makes up coinage? What legitimate coinage looks like? What the content of the metal is? Yeah, that's a legitimate function. That's a law that Congress can pass as necessary and proper to the execution of their main law, which is to coin money. They can do those things. All right? That's a dangerous power too, but there's checks and balances on it. And it says, and that last phrase in Article 1, Section 8, to make the necessary and proper clause, and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States. So it didn't say any power whatsoever they wanted to take. It's vested. When they use the term vested, it means spelled out. Okay? That it's spelled out specifically and given to a certain branch of the government in this Constitution. Now, Article 1, Section 9, if you're looking at it, is things that are prohibited. Okay? There's qualifications. And these are things that our founders had a lot of experience with in their dealings with Great Britain during, prior to and during the War for Independence. And so they spelled some things out. So basically, the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit. Oh, wow. Wait. So in other words, if there's a foreigner that comes into Ohio or Indiana, what does the federal government have the right to do? Well, they can't prohibit it prior to 1808. When did I say the Alien Sedition Acts were passed by Congress? 1798. So 10 years earlier, but 8 years after, 9 years after this was written, they're already violating it. The Alien Act violated Article 1, Section 9. But they said that you can put a tax on people, but you can't keep people from coming into the country. Yes. They're the same thing. Okay, in basic senses, they're the same thing. An act, you know, when a Congress brings legislation forward, it's called a bill. When it's passed by the Congress and signed by the president or allowed to go into law, it becomes an act. Okay? So that's referring to the specific piece of legislation that is finalized through the process and been approved all the way up. The law part of it is how it's carried out in operation. Okay? So the act itself is the actual document that was approved and signed off on by everybody that changes and adds to or takes away from the laws of the country. Okay? So that's the difference there. Okay, but then let's look at Article 1, Section 10 real quick. Because remember, in the 10th Amendment, we said that the powers that were not prohibited by the Constitution to the states, which means there has to be some place where we spell out that the states can't do certain things. Article 1, Section 10 is where that's spelled out. That's the section that says, states, you don't have the right to do these things because they're reserved to the national government, the federal government. You can't enter into treaties. It'd be interesting if Virginia could sign a treaty with France in violation of a difference between the national government and the country of France. You could see where the problems would lie. Yeah, you'd have maybe Florida signing a treaty with Spain and, other states signing treaties with China or whatever, you know, in order to enhance their own internal improvements. So Congress said, no, we can't do that. We can't have everybody just going and signing treaties with foreign countries. They had a problem with that under the Articles of Confederation. But it spells out all those things that you can't do as a state. Now, Article 2, Section 2. Let's move forward because as we're looking at the Alien Sedition Acts, we've got to look at what the president can do. And Article 2, Section 2 spells out the powers of the executive. Okay? Because we are talking about power here. Now, if you look in the second paragraph in yours, I'm sure that they're broken down into separate paragraphs. Second paragraph under Article 2, Section 2. It says that he, the president, shall have power. Does it stop there? Is there a period? No. Well, then I guess he doesn't just have power in general. Whatever he decides to do, he can utilize it. Sort of like the Alien and Sedition Acts. But it says that he can with make treaties, and when that's even with the advice and consent of the Senate. Appoint ambassadors, judges of the Supreme Court, officers of the United States. And then it goes on, he shall have power to fill vacancies that happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions. And then it tells what he has to give a report. He's the, go back into section 2, the first paragraph, he's the commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy. And has the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses. You've heard all these things. Where did you hear he has the power to deport people? He has the power to shut down newspapers. He has the power to tell you you can't be critical of him. Is it in the Constitution? Yes or no? How many think yes? Good, at least you're partially awake. How many think no? Okay. I do this in a spirit of love. It doesn't matter what you think. It matters what it says. So when somebody says, what do you think about that? Don't fall into the trap of telling, well, I think yes or I think no. Say, the Constitution doesn't give him the authority because it spells out specifically what he does. If we always go back when we're answering questions or even when we're talking to our elected officials with the Constitution says, the First Amendment, and we go back to the document. It's a standard. It is written. Because everything else is just our opinion. And opinion, everybody has opinions. And your opinion may be right, but if somebody's opinion is stronger and more emotionally enticing than yours, who's going to win in the public debate? The person whose opinion is more emotionally compelling. That's a standard tactic of folks who can't argue the facts, is to argue emotion. Yes?
And I would make that fall from this comment that much of the Constitution is written to prevent laws and actions being done on the basis of emotion.
Yes.
Emotion is deadly.
Yes, it can. It very well can be. And we've limited the powers, not just of Congress and the states, but of the executive and of the judiciary. Article 3, Section 3. Because when we're looking at the Alien and Sedition Acts, basically what with the Alien Act, what are we really saying that the president, we're handing the president the power to do? Solely. Because he's the only person that's referenced as having any power under that act. And what he's really doing is saying, well, I think Sarah is committing treason. Because she's here in this country and she's saying that the Federalists aren't the best political party out there. How dare you? We're going to put you in jail for 5 years or until I feel better about you. Because that's what the Alien Act did. I make the decision as president. I'm president. Guess what? I think you are causing dissent. You're going to jail, and when I feel better about you, I'll let you out. Is that dangerous? Or, you know what? I think Stephanie, walking down the street there, she looks like she's getting ready to pull together a coalition to oppose this law that I'm about to speak out of my mouth, because that's how laws are made now, is I just utter the words as the president, and it becomes law. And she looks like she's getting ready to put together a group of people, and I think you're calling them a tea party. I'm going to have to throw her out of the country. Bye-bye, Sam. You're out of here. You're going to Outer Gackmania. Okay? You're done. And if you come back in, I'll fine you $5,000 and put you in jail until I feel better about it. That's what the Alien Act really got down to. Yes?
Well, one of the words we use, I guess, this week is fiat.
Mm-hmm. We do use that word a lot.
Yeah, the word fiat in Latin means to make.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were trying to avoid was making up things as they went along. They want the Constitution is to help us not just make up laws the way we want to.
That's right. It is a boundary. It's a check upon human nature. See, our founders had a clear understanding of the basis of human nature. How many people believe that man is basically good? And that he's just he's humanitarian and he's altruistic and he wants the best for everybody and he's willing to sacrifice his own interests in order to get there. Okay, I didn't think I was going to see any hands go up. And you know what? Our founders didn't believe that either. They believed in a biblical view of man, that by basic nature, man is evil. And that he is all about self. And that he will do whatever it takes in order to advance and protect himself. And if you get a group of men together and hand them power without checks, you're committing suicide as a people. So you must bind them. As Thomas Jefferson said, you must bind them down with the chains of the Constitution. That's what the Constitution is. It's shackles. It's shackles upon human nature, run amok with too much power, not enough liberty. Okay, so that's the constitutional view of where power is. So now we're going to look at nullification, because we talked about in the Virginia resolutions a couple of big principles that they put forth. First one was nullification. Now, nullification is the doctrine that states have the power to declare a federal act unconstitutional. See, because if an act, going back to Luke's question, if an act is not constitutional, it's not a law. There are a lot of acts that Congress passes even today that do not have any constitutional basis because it goes beyond their enumerated powers. Now, the big problem is that a lot of people in our country have not learned this. You don't hear this in schools. You don't get this in colleges. As a matter of fact, you'd think attorneys would know this because, you know, they know the laws. The vast majority of attorneys never read the Constitution in law school. 3 years of law school, they never once read the Constitution. They read case laws. They read cases about the Constitution. And that's only an inference because really most of the cases nowadays have nothing to do with the Constitution. But the point is, we've got to go back and read the document because that tells us if Congress passes an act, whether or not it really is constitutional or not, do they have the authority to pass it? Have they been given the power? And if they haven't, it's unconstitutional. Now, when the federal government has overstepped its constitutional bounds, states may effectively negate the operation of the law in their state by a refusal to enforce it within the boundaries of their state. And this has happened. Has anybody ever heard of Real ID? Anybody ever heard of the Real ID Act? Okay, Arnie, you have. That was an act passed by Congress a few years ago that basically said that every state was going to have a uniform driver's license. And on it were going to be certain pieces of information on every person, including potentially a biometric ID or a fingerprint. Okay, and that every state had to do it. Well, what happened was, once the law got passed, a number of states said, no, we're not doing that. And enough states started saying it that they realized if they pushed it, the states could turn around and negate the law. And so they shelved it. Well, I'll tell you, unfortunately, Real ID's back. And there are states, including my own, who are in the process of moving forward with it now. Why? Because usually when Congress passes something that they know is blatantly unconstitutional and they hand it to the states, they hand it to them with a purse. They provide them monies in order to implement it. Where do they get the money from? Taxpayers, that's right, us. So they're going to use our money to implement a law to control us more. Now, let me ask you, is that liberty or is that power? That's power. It's raw power. That's a problem. Nullification is when the state says, you know what, we don't think that's good for our people. I don't care how much money you're handing us. We're not doing it. Now, it's based on the view that the Constitution is a compact and not a legislative act. Was there a legislature that put this Constitution in place? Right. There were state conventions that ratified it, but that's different. But the federal Congress didn't pass the Constitution. The convention did. The convention's a higher lawmaking body. And when Mr. Michaelis talks about Article 5 stuff at some point later, he'll talk to you about the difference between a convention and a legislature and who's got more power. So that's nullification. So that was the first thing Virginia said, was that, hey, we have a right to do this. And then there's interposition. Now, these two are very similar doctrines, except interposition's a little bit more important overall. And it's extremely important. It's the action of a lesser magistrate to protect the people from the illegitimate dictates of a higher magistrate. So it's not just the state against the federal government. See, interposition can happen when a local authority says the state's gone too far. Now, the states become protectors of their own, and we're the locals. We talked about the old Tip O'Neill saying, all politics is local. Well, the states or the locals become protectors of their own citizens, and they interpose against federal encroachments. Okay? Now, to give you an example of that, we're going to have an exercise. I need 4 volunteers from the students. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, come on up, you guys. Luke, Brittany, Maria, and Blaine. Come on up. We need 4 people. Okay, Maria, I want you to stand right here, okay? Yeah, come on around this way so you don't get into the cords. Oh, and by the way, folks, during camp this week, this area in here, do not come through it. We have a lot of expensive equipment and a lot of cords in here. We don't want anybody getting hurt or likewise having a big bill when you go home this week. And I don't think we're going to. Maria, you stand here and face this way, okay? Blaine, come on up here, right up in front, okay? Okay, now turn and face that way. Brittany, right here. Same way. Turn and face that way. Luke, right here. Turn and face that way. Okay, I'm an outside threat. I'm the United Nations. And I want to issue an edict that says that Maria can't have a firearm. Period. Luke, you're the federal government. What are you supposed to do? Not let me do that. So put them up. Come on, put up the dukes, okay? You're going to fight me over this, okay? You're interposing yourself between me and Maria, okay? But what happens is if the UN and I come to you and say, you know what, here's what we want to do. I know you guys want to, the federal government, you guys want to get a little piece of the action over in Afghanistan, so we'll supply you with 50,000 UN troops in order to help you over there. And all of a sudden, Mr. Luke, federal government, turns around and says, you know what, I think the UN's right. We need to take Maria's guns away from her. So what's Brittany do? Brittany's now the state legislature or the state executive. What is Brittany supposed to do? Brittany's supposed to put her dukes up. Come on, put them up there. Come on, you can do it. Oh, come on. Now, if you're a weak state, this strong federal government's going to roll right over you, okay? You're the next line of protection. She is interposing herself as the state between the federal government, who's now going crazy, and poor little Maria back there, who's sitting there shivering, wondering why she doesn't have any bullets in her 380 right now. Okay? So Brittany's got her fists up. But then Luke gets smart, and he doesn't like to see his face all marred up or bruises. And so he thinks, you know what? I know. Hey, Brittany. You know that road project that you've been wanting to do, that new bridge you've been wanting to put in there in your town, that bridge to nowhere? How about I got some friends, okay? I got some friends on the inside in Congress. And you know what? They owe me a couple political favors because they're all my party. Here's what I'm going to do. If you look the other way, get out of my way, I'm going to give you $10 million in a grant for you to get that bridge built. What do you think? Now, Brittany, because finances are tight and the state really wants that bridge to nowhere, turns around. Uh-oh. Sheriff Blaine, the county sheriff of, oh, help me out, county, has now decided, you know what? If I let these two jokers take her guns away from her, pretty soon they're going to take mine away from me too. And I won't have any authority left. And so he stands there and says, you know what? I can't allow this to happen. So he puts the dukes up. And he's looking at, but you know what? The feds are back here, and so they've already cut their deal, so they're kind of just kind of sitting over by the side for a little bit. But Brandon here is looking at this and is like, county sheriff, because he said, hey, not in my county. You're not. She's a citizen of my county. You're not coming in here. I'm not going to let you do this to her.
Yeah.
Nobody's taking anybody's guns away in my county. Right? Preach it, brother. Come on. But problem is, Brittany has caught on to the game. And so she gets to thinking, so she turns back around, whispers in federal government's ear, hey, can we do a little something here to kind of get him nullified?
No.
Well, and of course you're going to stand there and say no. But so Luke says, you know what, we got some federal grants for law enforcement, and you know what, I'm sure that we could write them to the state, and then we could like change a couple of the rules so that you can take them and hand them off all to him without him having to bid for them. Now, Blaine here, as the sheriff, needs a new cruiser, okay? He also is having some problems with getting some of his forensic work done, so he needs to, like, he's been hiring independent forensic experts to test his evidence. That's expensive. He's a county sheriff. He's got a limited budget. He needs to hire a couple more deputies because, you know, there's been a crime spree in his neighborhood. Seems like people are starting to figure out that citizens may not have guns anymore. So, Blaine sits there, and Brittany comes to him as the state and says, you know what, Blaine, here, and she puts out the hand of peace, hand of friendship, and of course that hand has a bag sitting in it. And she says, you know what, if you just take a powder on this particular issue, it won't affect you. We'll write it in that law enforcement's guns are sacrosanct. We won't touch them. And here's this big pot of grant money, and we've got it earmarked right for you, and you can do whatever you want to with it. Matter of fact, you can build a new jailhouse if you want to. See, he's starting to scratch the chin, the home. He's starting to think about it. And he looks back at Maria, and she's small, and he figures, well, you know what? You know, she really won't hurt me in my next election. She can't really put up much of a fight. She's one of those Tea Party folks, so she doesn't have a lot of friends. And Blaine turns. Poor Maria. There's now nobody to interpose for her. Because there's been a failure all the way up the chain of authority to do what is right and lawful. They've ignored their boundaries. But all it takes is for any one of them down the chain to grow a spine. Plant their feet, cross their arms across their chest, and say, not in my town.
Not in my town.
And you know what? I don't care if she sends in the state marshal. I don't care if he sends in the FBI to come in. You know what's going to happen? They're going to come in and he's going to pull his constitution out and say, I'm the authority in this town, and you guys either get out of my town or I'm going to put you in my jail. And do you know who, you know what? He's got the constitutional authority to do so. And they know it, so what do? They turn around, they leave, and the UN sitting back are going, curses foiled again! And that is the doctrine of interposition. Okay, everybody sit down, give them a hand. Thank you all for doing that. And that is an example of the doctrine of interposition. Yes.
Would interposition be related? Right now, the state of Arizona is trying to protect the border.
Yes.
Against illegal immigration.
Right.
The job the federal government is supposed to do, but the state is stepping in there to do it.
Right.
And would that be a form of interposition?
That is a form of interposition. That is the state stepping up where the national government has decided to take a powder or actually do something that's unconstitutional, the state stepped in and said, no, not in my jurisdiction, you're not. We're going to take authority here. Anybody remember Hurricane Katrina back a few years ago? Okay? Massive damage. Everything's going on. And what happens? The federal government comes riding in. This is under the Bush administration. Bush administration comes to the governor of the state of Louisiana and says, we want to federalize your National Guard. What did Kathleen Blanco, the governor of Louisiana, say to Bush? No. She said no in a very emphatic way. But she said no. She said, I understand my rights, and I'm not going to allow you to federalize state troops. No, you're not going to do it. She nullified that action of the federal government. And to interpose between the feds and her people. Now, Webster's definition in 1828, and we like using this for the IOTC instructors, and if you for parents, get yourself a copy of the 1828 American Dictionary of the English Language by Noah Webster. Okay? Incredible resource because, as I mentioned, every word determines the question of liberty and power, but it also determines it as defined by the definitions they used. Because if you look at a modern Webster's Dictionary, the definition of many of our words in the Constitutions have changed. We've become modernist and then postmodernist, and we're changing the definition to the point where we don't even know what the word is anymore. We have to go back to the original sources. We've got to go back to Webster. And basically, a being placing or coming between, an intervention. And he talks about the Baltic Sea in Germany and Sweden, but you know that's just physical geography. He says, an intervenient agency as the interposition of the magistrate, Blaine, in quieting sedition. Well, the sedition just happened to be coming the wrong direction, coming from the government rather than coming from the people. So, and it says, how many evidence have we of divine interposition in favor of good men? And if you think about the Psalms of David are full of interposition where God is taking his cause for him. And he's standing up against his enemies. That's interposition as well, from a biblical sense. A mediation, an agency between parties. And anything interposed. Well, we really get down to one of the basic arguments and reasons why the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions were passed is what type of country do we have? Is it a consolidated government? And where the states cede most of their authority over to a federal government which acts as the final authority in most matters. That state powers are limited, the federal powers are virtually unlimited, and the government must grow to meet the needs of a growing society. In other words, we gotta have more government. There ought to be a law. Stephanie, there you go again. There ought to be a law. Now the federalists held to this view of a consolidated government. In other words, all the powers should be in the central government. Now there's another view, and that's called a confederated government. The states retain their sovereignty. Anybody know what the word sovereignty means? Yes. Yes. God-given authority. Okay? Their authority. They cede only certain functions and powers to the federal government. Thank you, Noel. I'm speeding. The states retain the right to secede from the Confederation if it becomes injurious to their interests. In other words, they can leave the Confederation. Go it alone. Secession. You've heard it before. The health of society is maintained by local action, i.e. the sheriff, the town councils. All politics is local, and the government that's closest to the people governs best. Those are the concepts. Now, Jefferson and the Republicans held to the principle that the Constitution established this form of relationship. And I truly believe that they're right, although we've had an intervening major war that kind of changed the whole structure. Well, Madison's view from Federalist 28, it says it may safely be received as an axiom in our political system that the state governments will, in all possible contingencies, afford complete security against invasions of public liberty by the national authority. Brittany, don't fall down on your job, Mr. Madison's watching. Projects of usurpation, that's the UN and the feds, cannot be masked under pretenses so likely to escape the penetration of select bodies of men as of the people at large. The legislatures will have better means of information. They can discover the danger at a distance, and possessing all the organs of civil power and the confidence of the people, they can at once adopt a regular plan of opposition in which they can combine all the resources of the community. They can readily communicate with each other in the different states and unite their common forces for the protection of their common liberty. That was what Mr. Madison said in Federalist 28 about states. In it, he talked about interposition and nullification. In it, he also brought an interesting concept that I think we've lost. Who has the most power, the federal or the state governments today? Come on. Federal. No, they don't. They really don't. They've usurped quite a bit of authority. But under this Constitution, we just looked at Articles 8, 9, and 10. Now, truly, Articles 8 and 9, that's a very short list of things that the federal government can actually do. And Article 10 is a very short list of the things that a state government can't do. And if we know from the 10th Amendment, everything else the states have. Who has the most authority in this country? Who has the most power? The states, if they choose to exercise it. But they don't choose to exercise it because they believe a legal fiction about a confederated government instead of a consolidated. Now, what are the impact of the principles, the immediate impact at that time? Well, no other states would sign on to the resolutions. They were too afraid to. 10 rejected them outright, and 4 others never responded. So is that the end of the story? No. We had the election of 1800, and we don't have enough time to really go into it, but Jefferson ran against Adams. And Jefferson's victory in 1800 as the third president of the United States was the beginning of the end of the Federalist Party. They were out there loud enough and long enough on the Alien and Sedition Acts that people started paying attention. They were allowed to expire and not be renewed when Jefferson took office. And the Virginia-Kentucky resolutions were useful as a propaganda tool against the Federalists. Very clearly, that was one of the main reasons why those two things were passed. Now, we moved up, and in the Civil War period, we had that argument about states' rights versus a consolidated government. We do not have time today to really go into the Civil War issue, but they used the principle of secession as an answer to encroachment of the national government. And we know what the bloody result and consequences were of an overreaching government and states being driven to that last resort. Now, continuing importance, we got modern issues today, and we can talk about these all during the week. Today's Alien and Sedition Acts. We have the National Defense Authorization Act. Anybody heard of the NDAA? Few of you have. It authorizes unmanned aircraft, the drones that we're now hearing in the media, to surveil the American people. So the military can fly drone unmanned planes and videotape what you're doing, you know, use infrared, whatever they want to do. The military can indefinitely detain citizens suspected of terrorism on American soil, which is a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. Guys, it's starting to sound like the Alien Act. You have no right to trial or defense. It can be an indefinite incarceration without notice. All because the federal government, i.e. the president, can determine that you are a threat to the country. The Alien and Sedition Acts are back, ladies and gentlemen. It's called the NDAA. The president makes the decision. They also have the Enemy Expatriation Act. U.S. citizens can have their citizenship taken away from them without process if they're suspected of, quote, giving aid and comfort to an enemy of the United States. The Constitution already provides a process for declaring treason. That was Article 3, Section 3 that we looked at in the Constitution. This circumvents that process. The bill was sponsored by Republican representatives and Senators Joe Lieberman, who's supposedly an independent and Jewish, so you'd think he'd understand the atrocities of the Nazis, which is what the Enemy Expatriation Act really harkens back to, and Scott Brown, who the Tea Party feted as the great savior in Massachusetts, who's turned out to be anything but. Yes, Webster.
Sure. Frankly, I would say the Enemy Expatriation Act, the Sedition Act, just a bunch of fancy
language. Yes, it's more the Alien Act, but the point is, remember where the Alien Act of 1798 was only on aliens residing in the country? The Enemy Expatriation Act is against U.S. citizens. So they've taken it that next step. Okay, other issues of overreach, Obamacare. Yes?
The president is now also taking under his authority to execute American citizens in
Yes. Anwar al-Awlaki, yes. Yeah, for those of you who are interested, if you go to our website at principledpolicy.com, we have a listing of radio programs that we do on a regular basis. We touch on all these topics, on interposition, nullification, Obamacare, NDAA, Enemy Expatriation Act, the Anwar al-Awlaki issue. Chuck and I do the analysis and discussion, and we've got it all of our archives are up on our website at principledpolicy.com. But basically, you know, Obamacare mandates the individuals have to do things. There's no provision in Article 1, Section 8 for Congress to have passed this law. You get fines and sanctions. They can pass taxes, but not this. The states responded, though, and they filed lawsuits, which the Supreme Court, the USSC, the United States Supreme Court, is ruling possibly today. Would be interesting in the 214th anniversary of the Alien Act that they would actually rule on an overreach of the federal government and hopefully come out the right way on the constitutionality of the proposal. Now, our solutions, the states are stepping up to the plate to create solutions to respond to the, once again, overreach of the federal government. There's been somewhat of an outcry, although it's not strong enough, against the Enemy Expatriation Act and NDAA. What can citizens do? Well, get educated. That's what you're here for. What about our elected representatives? They need to understand the impact of the votes and the fact that they need to vote within the bounds of the Constitution. Get involved, kids. That's what we're saying. Get involved. Get your parents involved. That's it. We don't have any time for questions because we need to let you guys take a little bit of a break before your next class starts. Thank you for your attention and thank you for participation.
Well, that was Barry Sheets, the executive director of the Institute for Principled Policy, teaching a class on the principles of 98, a little workshop on how interposition works. I think you will agree that was a very interesting presentation, even more interesting on video, which you can get again at www.campamerican.com, campamerican.com. You can find out more about campamerican.com. You can see this year's agenda and see who the speakers are, see how to sign up. We love to have young people, 12 and up, but we also like to have adults. The accommodations are somewhat different for the adults, but nonetheless, we do make room. We like to have adults. A limited number of people can come as volunteers. Other people can come and pay a tuition or even pay a donation to camp. We've had a number of people that have come to camp. We're so impressed they left us with a very good donation, and we would solicit those donations because Camp American is a 501c3. Your donations are tax deductible. Yes, we still maintain our 501c3, and we are a great educational opportunity. Again, it's in Angola, Indiana. The dates this year are June 15th through the 21st. June 15th through the 21st. That's Sunday evening through Saturday morning, and it's a good time to be had by all. There's great classes. There are great recreational activities. We have skiing, boating, tubing, go-karting, mini golf, you name it. We do a lot of it. We'll probably go roller skating. We go bowling one night. So there is plenty to do at Camp American, and we would welcome you to come up there. A lot of people say, oh, it's a long drive. Believe me, well worth the drive. Well worth the drive. And as you can hear on some of the classes that we've been running the last few weeks while Mr. Sheets has been very busy, it's very informative. And we would love to have your kids, and we would love to have you to come to Camp American. And again, if you want to get a hold of us, www.campamerican.com. If you want to get hold of the Institute for Principled Policy, because Barry and I do teach classes on the U.S. Constitution locally here in the Central Ohio area, and we have other folks in the Central Ohio area, some people down in Lancaster, Canal Winchester. We've helped people get classes started down in the Logan area. So again, we'd love to have you at camp. We'd love to hear from you at the Institute for Principled Policy. That's principledpolicy.com, principled with an ED on the end, principled policy. And we have to say, now that we're out of time, Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.